This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Noah Shachman, writes the blog Danger Room for Wired magazine about national security and new weaponry. He's a contributing editor at Wired and a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution. Shachman recently wrote an article called The Secret History of Iraq's Invisible War. He says that in the early years of the war, the U.S. military developed a technology so secret that soldiers would refuse to acknowledge its existence, and reporters who even mentioned the gear were promptly escorted out of the country. But Shachman was recently invited for a visit by a defense contractor which made this technology and was ready to discuss its evolution and capabilities. We're going to talk about what Shachman learned. Noah Shachman, welcome to Fresh Air. Describe what you mean about Iraq's invisible war.
You know, we all see this war on television where bombs go off and people shoot each other, and territories won and territories lost, and you know, tribes are influenced or not. But behind the scenes and in the airwaves, there's this invisible war. It's for the control of the electromagnetic spectrum, the control of the airwaves. And basically what happens is insurgents use garage door openers or cell phones to set off bombs from a safe distance to remotely trigger them. And the U.S. has tried all number of different ways to try to block those triggers with broadcasts of their own. And so there's this competing battle that's gone on, a sort of cat and mouse game, a technological game of chess.
So the goal of the jammers, the radio frequency jammers that the U.S. military has been designing, is to prevent the insurgents from using remote control devices to blow up bombs.
Yeah, basically the remote control bomb for a number of years in Iraq was the weapon of choice for the insurgency. It gave them a chance to attack U.S. troops at a safe distance. And at their peak, these bombs were wounding 1,000 soldiers a month. And then you think on top of that, all the civilians that were hurt as well. So this was the number one tool of the Iraqi insurgency. And so the U.S. goal was to get them back to what they called the Wile E. Coyote level of weaponry. You might remember from those old cartoons, Wile E. Coyote would push down the plunger and then the bomb would explode. That's what the U.S. wanted to have happen here. They wanted to get the insurgents closer to their weapons so that they might be able to counterattack or interdict them.
Yeah, so you can actually see a target. You can see an insurgent about to blow something up.
Yeah, exactly. And so over a number of years, these jammers got better and better and better and sort of cut off that remote control bomb from the Iraq insurgents and forced them back to Wile E. Coyote levels.
But the problem that the American military ended up having is that these radio frequency jamming devices were jamming the military's devices too.
Right. So these jammers really hadn't been used before in this context. And so they started out pretty crude, basically just screaming out a signal at all times in all directions. You know, as if you and I were having a conversation and a third person tried to talk in your ear just so you couldn't hear what I was saying. So basically, all these jammers were introduced into Iraq, one after the other after the other, and they were all screaming into each other's ear. And they were all canceling each other out, not to mention all the U.S. radios that were being used. The jammers were canceling them out, too. And American troops were also using robots to try to defuse bombs. And those were remotely operated, and the jammers would go after them as well.
So how did the military get around that? How were they able to prevent insurgents from using remote control devices to detonate IEDs while still allowing the military to communicate through radio frequencies?
Well, one way they did it is something that, you know, we do instinctually, which is one of us talks and then the other stops and listens to what the other has to say. And that's kind of what they designed the jammers to do. They designed one to sort of radiate a signal and then stop for a second, and while the other one did. And so they developed these timing protocols that allowed them to do that. They also developed different techniques to jam these bombs. Rather than just broadcast out a signal, what's called active jamming, they did reactive jamming, which is they listened for that remote trigger, that cell phone that would set off a bomb, and they would intercept that signal, and then they would broadcast out something similar but kind of confusing to the receiver, stopping the bomb from going off.
So did the radio frequency jammers manage to get the insurgents back to the Wile E. Coyote era?
It took a long time. It took about 4 years, but eventually it did happen. Basically, the most sophisticated of these jammers not only could broadcast on a wide range of frequencies, but it could also spoof the software connection between one cell phone and another. And once that happened, the insurgents were pretty much cooked. And you saw the rate of remote-controlled improvised bombs drop dramatically from, you know, from 1,000 soldiers getting hurt a month to a dozen.
So did the insurgents come up with alternate devices?
Yeah, so the good news was the insurgents were robbed of their weapon of choice and basically had to go back to primitive means of fighting the Americans. The bad news is those primitive means work pretty darn well, somewhat in Iraq, but especially in Afghanistan. I was there a couple years ago in Helmand province, and what the insurgents had done was use the terrain to rob the American forces of basically every high-tech protective mechanism they had developed since 2001. They planted their bombs in gullies and on mud paths so that these big hulking armored vehicles that American troops had used to protect themselves, that they couldn't go there. They made their bombs out of wood and fertilizer so they couldn't be detected by metal detectors. They basically turned them into old-fashioned landmines that you just step on to detonate them. They didn't use these remote control triggers, and so as a result, the jammers were useless.
And you read that a lot of the military equipment that was made for Iraq's urban warfare on highways just didn't work in the fields of Afghanistan in places like Helmand.
Yeah, so I remember this one foot patrol in a town called Moba Khan. It was really just a collection of farms, and walking by several bombs that I just happened not to step on myself, and that a Marine happened to notice before he stepped on. In fact, I was involved in this, witness to this kind of day-long gun battle between these two compounds at Moba Khan, and honestly, I mean, I was kind of scared, but the scariest moment of all was the walk back from those compounds about a kilometer along a road that we knew had bombs planted in it somewhere. That was probably the most terrifying thing I had to do, putting one foot in front of the other and hoping to God that there wasn't a bomb underneath.
What were you looking for with each step?
Honestly, what I was looking for was just to put my foot exactly where the guy before me had gone.
But I mean, were you told to look to any particular evidence to indicate that there was, a mine?
No, these guys were so tired and so used to it that they didn't tell me to look for anything. I just tried to put my foot where they put their feet.
Right, right. Well, meanwhile, you think that there was one occasion when you were in Iraq that one of the radio frequency jammers might have saved your life when you were near an IED.
Yeah, I was with a bomb squad in 2005, and they were based out of Baghdad, and they got a call to go pretty much outside the Abu Ghraib prison to a place they called the Death X, because it was an intersection of two highways where people got blown up all the time. And in the middle of the road was supposed to be a suspicious package, but instead was just a pair of pants. And I remember them being like, "We've got the Dockers. We've got the Dockers." But it was kind of a lighthearted moment. But the kind of creepy reality underneath was that insurgents would often put these fake packages out there, these fake bombs out there, as a way of luring out a bomb squad, and then would have a real bomb nearby that they try to set off to get the responders. And sure enough, as we were driving away from the pants, we rolled over an artillery shell wired up to a long-range cordless telephone, and that was an improvised bomb.
But it didn't detonate.
But it didn't go off. No, it didn't go off, which was good. That was a good thing. And you can't say for sure why something doesn't happen. You can't, like, prove a negative. But, you know, I'm pretty sure it was those jammers blocking the signal to that bomb.
How long do you think it will be until jammers like the ones we're using are used against us?
That's a great question. It's a hot topic in military circles because those jammers are pretty easily repurposed to block GPS signals. And basically everything the military does is dependent on GPS, from how it directs its bombs from the air to how it communicates with one another to how it keeps track of where everybody is on the battlefield.
The drones?
The drones, right. That's a big – they're relying on GPS as well. And so that's long been a concern is what happens if the GPS system starts getting jammed.
So this radio frequency jamming technology that we've been talking about that has helped the U.S. military prevent remote control devices from detonating IEDs, this was supposed to be not only invisible technology but secret technology. And even reporters who found out about it were told that they could not write about it. They could not make it public. And you know even of one reporter who was – well, what happened to him?
So my friend and colleague David Axe in 2006 was doing a little reporting for a blog of mine at the time. And he casually mentioned in a blog post that these jammers were, you know, operating in a Humvee convoy that he was riding in. And the next day he got a, you know, some guys came into his tent and basically detained him for 36 hours and then promptly threw him out of Iraq. And it took years for him to kind of like repair his reputation with the U.S. military for even mentioning that these jammers existed.
Did you know about these jammers before and you agreed to keep that secret?
I tried to write about jammers, but write about them carefully early on. But that didn't stop a Army colonel in Baghdad from hauling me into his office, showing me printed out stacks of my online articles and calling me a friend to Al-Qaeda for mentioning that these jammers existed. You know, the sort of crazy part about the military and how it keeps its secrets or not is in the early days of the Iraq war, companies were issuing press releases about how they had sold jammers and what these jammers did and all their various characteristics. And then the military was like, oh, wait. Actually, all that stuff is secret. You can't write about it. So I tried to move forward on it, but step carefully.
So meanwhile, ITT, which is the contractor that manufactures many of these radio frequency jammers, invited you in to talk with you about the technology and where it's headed. So what changed that now they want to talk about it and they're able to talk about it? They want you to write about it.
Well, a couple things changed. Number one, the threat of radio control bombs has subsided a bit. Number two, there's some really fierce competition for some truly enormous contracts from the military for the next generation of jammers. And so ITT, like every other business, wants a little bit of positive press. And so they knew that I had written about the fight against improvised bombs several times. And they knew I had a way of handling sensitive information. And so they reached out to me. I was even more surprised when they started talking about the capabilities of these jammers, and I was completely shocked when they actually invited me to their lab to see the next generation of jammers.
So what did you learn about the next generation of jammers?
What I learned is that the military's got a lot of ambition for these devices, much more than just jamming. They want them basically to become spying devices to figure out where people are talking on their cell phones and what they're saying. They want them to be able to block enemy drones or enemy sensors. They want them to be able to block out GPS if need be. And they want them all to be networked together so that you only have to operate one maybe in a given convoy instead of having them all sort of blast at the same time. So it's a real sort of leap ahead.
Let's talk a little bit about drones, those remote-controlled planes that can spy or drop bombs. And they really are changing how wars are being fought by the U.S. military. Do you want to describe some of the ways drones are changing warfare now?
Well, let's just look at all the different wars that the U.S. seems to be in at the moment, right? In Pakistan, drones are kind of the weapon of choice. You look at Yemen, there's drone operations happening there pretty regularly. And you look at Libya, NATO's first combat casualty there was a drone helicopter. So really all over the world, the U.S. military is now turning to its flying robots as its first troops of choice.
Do you have an estimate for how many drones are out there now?
The answer is thousands, but it's kind of a misleading number because most drones are actually these tiny kind of handheld model airplane looking things that there's a lot of them, but they don't necessarily have the kind of strategic impact that like the Predator Reaper drones do. And those are the bigger ones that you hear about that are, you know, doing so much damage in Pakistan.
Yeah, I was reading about those new bug-sized drones that are under development. Maybe some of them are already being used. I was reading about them in the New York Times. What do you know about those really small drones?
Yeah, it's been an area of interest for years at places like DARPA. That's the Pentagon's kind of way out sci-fi research arm. And that sci-fi is becoming reality. They've got drones that are, size of of your hand, maybe two hands. They've got flapping wings like real bugs or birds. And, you know, they've got prototypes that are flying around.
And what are they designed to do? What does the military hope that they will be able to do?
Spy on people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Without them noticing. I'm projecting forward, okay, like 10, 15, 20 years in the future. But, you know, it could definitely happen that, you know, there'll be something flying in the air. You'll just think it's a little bird hovering around. And instead it'll have a camera and it'll be watching what you do and listening to what you say.
Now, in terms of the Predator drone, which can and does drop bombs, they are remote controlled from places far away, sometimes as far away as the United States, where, you know, somebody would be controlling a drone that's in Pakistan. There are concerns that it's for the military like a video game, you know, where because you are so distant from and detached from the actual target that you don't feel the actual human cost of the bomb that is being dropped, especially if there's collateral damage and people who were not your targets are accidentally killed. You had the opportunity to actually sit with men who were controlling drones. This was in Vegas, am I right?
Yeah, so north of Vegas, pretty far north. You go up past the city, past the big prison that's out there in the desert, and you keep going and going and going to this little, you know, sort of one-street town with a mini casino off the edge. And just past the casino, inside the gate, is a pretty nondescript office building. And inside that office building is basically a series of cockpits. And each one of those cockpits has guys flying in Iraq or Afghanistan. And, you know, there's something to be said about the argument that this removes people from the consequences of warfare. I remember sitting with this one pilot, and he told me a story about how he dropped his first bomb using a Reaper drone. That's the Predator's kind of bigger version. And then he went home afterwards and fed his daughter blueberry pancakes, her favorite. And that's a pretty odd juxtaposition to go from bombs to blueberry pancakes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
On the other hand, guys like him are very professionally trained and spend years and years and years rehearsing this stuff. And, you know, if nothing else, collateral damage is a big professional mistake and a sign that something went wrong. And these guys do not like to get things wrong.
General Petraeus is likely to become the new CIA director and Leon Panetta, Secretary of Defense. So just looking at General Petraeus, who says he would, you know, resign from the military if he becomes a CIA director, what does it say to you that a military leader is likely to be heading the CIA?
Well, it's not just Petraeus, right? The director of national intelligence is a former general. Jim Clapper, the head of the National Security Agency, is a general, Keith Alexander. You know, there's an increasing fusion of the military world and in the intelligence world. And you see that with Petraeus going to the CIA and Leon Panetta going to the Pentagon. What used to be very distinct activities governed by different legal regimes, reporting to different panels in Congress have increasingly the lines between them have gotten increasingly fuzzy.
So have the military and the CIA been operating more closely in Iraq, Afghanistan, or Pakistan than in previous wars?
Yeah, for sure. You know, you just look at that raid on Abbottabad, on bin Laden's compound. You know, you had the guys from Joint Special Operations Command working with the CIA kind of hand in glove. And that kind of thing didn't often happen before. But starting in 2001, you know, in the initial push on Afghanistan and through today, that cooperation has gotten tighter and tighter and tighter.
And has that cooperation, do you know, been welcomed by the CIA and the military? Or is there more of a turf war between them?
It's like more and more of this war, this global war that America has spent $1 trillion on, more and more of it is receding into the shadows, right? You've got these private contractors who are maybe accountable, maybe they're not. They're using technologies that are highly classified that were, you know, the great unwashed aren't allowed to see. A lot of this war is now being conducted by secretive special operations units and by, you know, clandestine CIA paramilitary organizations. And there was a time when you could see the war unfold at least a little bit on TV. And that time is kind of past.
Well, you know, one of the consequences of that is that we lose track more and more, I think, the American public that were involved in these wars, because we don't see the same number of battles on TV. They're being, some of it's remote controlled, some of it is so secretive. So I think Americans are growing increasingly detached.
Yeah, and I think because it's very difficult to tell, you know, those secret warrior stories, it's hard to keep support for the wars up too, right? I mean, at least in Iraq, even when things were going to hell, at least you could hear from those individual soldiers. Well, now, you know, if it's all being done, you know, under the cover of night, it's pretty tough to get them to talk, and you can't really hear what it's really like. And I think that that is one of many reasons why, you know, war fatigue seems to have set in so greatly.
So in your reporting, you know, understanding the military's need to keep some operations and some technology a secret, and at the same time, as a journalist wanting to report on things and uncover things, how do you try to maintain a balance between secrecy and uncovering? And how often have you been given guidelines by the military?
It's a difficult and it's a fine line to walk, but it's one that if you apply a little common sense, you know, I don't think it's that hard to figure out what's really secret and what's just stamped secret by some, you know, government bureaucrat. You know, the fact that the U.S. military has jammers and that they block certain kinds of remote control bombs, you know, that's not such a big secret. What frequencies they use particularly, you know, what their exact ranges is, okay, that's a legitimate secret. That's something that could threaten the lives of soldiers on the battlefield, and that I choose not to report. You know, similarly, there are things that, you know, I've seen in Iraq and Afghanistan that are secret. I'm not even sure why. You know, it's like a particular mapping technology or something that, I mean, honestly, like Google Earth is cooler and better. Here's a great example. The military has a base in, quote unquote, Southwest Asia, where they run the air war from, where they run the air war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And you are totally not allowed to say where that base is or what its name is. That being said, you can find it on Google, right? So a lot of what the military says is secret really isn't that secret. So I guess the test I use is it really going to threaten anybody's life in a place like Iraq or Afghanistan? Am I really going to put a soldier in jeopardy? If that's the case, then no way am I going to report on it. I'm not going to jeopardize one of those guys. But if it's just one of these kind of secrets of convenience, then forget about it.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Noah Shachman is a contributing editor at Wired magazine and edits its national security blog, Danger Room. He's also a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution. You'll find links to his recent articles on our website, freshair.npr.org. Lots of people have given up trying to find a partner through parties, bars, dates, work, neighbors, friends, laundromats, bus stops, coffee shops. And they've turned to online dating sites where there's lots of choices and where they'll maybe, maybe not, find a good match. Online dating sites and how they make their matches is the subject of the article Looking for Someone in the current edition of The New Yorker by my guest, Nick Palmgarten. If you're wondering if he looked for his match online, the answer is no. He's only been on two dates in his life, and on the second, he met the woman who became his wife. They've been together 23 years. Nick Palmgarten, welcome to Fresh Air. So you have an image I really like. You basically say that online dating is serving the function for middle-class adults that college serves for younger people, because when you're in college, you have a really large pool of single people that you can meet. And then after college, that pool keeps getting smaller and smaller as your circle of friends shrinks and as many of them get coupled off.
Yeah, you run out of friends of friends, and then you run out of friends of friends of friends. And, you know, what internet dating provides is a much bigger pool. And with that pool, you know, theoretically, you have a better chance of meeting someone better. It also means that it takes a lot of work, you know, to sort through all the possible mates that are there for you.
And it means you're making choices based on information as opposed to making choices meeting somebody and having a feeling about them.
Right. It's not just the look or even that one thing that someone says or a feeling that you have in that moment. It's, you know, a written and curated presentation, you know, the dating profile, you know, that tends to favor someone who might write well or be clever. But I guess the idea is that you are reverting in a way back to an older way of dating or of getting to know people, which is you get to know a little bit about them before you meet them, which has an almost kind of, you know, 19th century feel to it.
Let's talk a little bit about how the online dating services work. They all have slightly different theories of compatibility. So why don't you choose one and tell us their theory of compatibility?
I spent time sort of with three or four sites. One of them is eHarmony, which is probably the squarest of the bunch. It's the one that is most overtly committed to finding you a spouse or a partner for life. And their approach is based on some clinical psychological findings that say that, you know, compatibility is important, that the idea that opposites attract is a bit of a canard, that opposites attract, well, they also attack. That's the term they use. So what they try to do is they try to identify, you know, personality features that make people compatible.
Now, they actually have a relationship lab that you visited. What happens in the relationship lab?
Well, the cool thing about the relationship lab is that it's run by a husband and wife team, sort of a Nick and Nora of relationship research. What they do is they have married couples come in periodically and go through a bunch of tests, you know, little exercises, and they observe those exercises and look for clues to the kinds of things that would indicate that these are happy marriages or less than happy marriages. I mean, they don't do a lot of judging on scene, but they do pick up on little cues. You know, for example, if a husband rolls his eyes when his wife says something, that's a sign of contempt. And apparently contempt is not a good emotion to have in a marriage.
So in the eHarmony relationship lab, they're trying to find successful couples and figure out what it is about them that makes them a good match,
right.
So that they could
right.
duplicate that in people who are looking for a match?
That's the idea. I mean, to a certain extent, I sometimes wonder if there's a little bit of Potemkin in the enterprise, that they want to be showing you that they're doing this as much as the fact that they are just doing it. But the idea
is to make it seem more scientific?
Right. I mean, you know, all these sites, they all have an approach that they abide by, yes, but the approach is also their sort of their selling point. But they are trying to figure out, you know, they're trying to find a secret sauce. Another site is chemistry.com, and that's owned by Match. And Match started it actually in response to eHarmony. And, you know, they've identified personality types. They have, you know, four personality types: an explorer, negotiator, builder, director. And these are, you know, these correlate to brain chemicals, neurochemicals, dopamine, estrogen, serotonin, testosterone. And, you know, they feel that there are certain compatibilities in their matrices of compatibilities that better indicate which two people might get along better and have a long and happier life.
Did you take the test to find out which type you were?
I did. I mean, it's hard to resist a test. And I found out I was an explorer negotiator.
And what does
and
that
I had
mean?
My,
what does that mean?
I think it means that I'm, you know, I'm daring, but I'm, you know, I'm willing to take on all kinds of crazy adventures, but at the same time, I'm very respectful of others. I think these are all flattering categories, by the way. It's sort of like your horoscope. It's always telling you things that you want to hear. But the funny thing is that I took the test, and then I had my wife take the test just for fun, and it turned out that I was one of the, you know, the 10 people that was recommended for her. So I'm one of her matches on chemistry.com.
I mean, of all
she
the
didn't
people,
come up as,
she didn't ask for you. She just put her personality in and you came up?
Right. And it wasn't even my real name because, you know, I didn't feel comfortable going on with a real name.
So there's hope for your marriage after more than 20 years.
Yeah. But she didn't come up as one of my 10, though. That's you know.
Oh, she didn't?
No. I can't.
Oh, you
I came up
you
as, one,
came
of
up
her
as
10.
One of hers, but she didn't come up as one of yours.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know how that. I don't, maybe that's because I'm an explorer. I don't know.
Right. Okay. So chemistry.com is owned by Match.com, and Match.com is one of the big ones. You said that Match.com takes stock of your stated and revealed preferences. What does that mean? What is the equation that they're doing?
Well, most sites begin with a questionnaire. Match is no different. You answer a bunch of questions describing who you are and describing what you think you're looking for. But what they've found and what other people have found on these sites is that your behavior online, who you click on, who you receive messages from, says more about you often than your own answers. And what they do is they figure out that there's sort of a disconnect, a dissonance between your stated preference and your revealed preference. And they sort of, they plug both of those into, you know, the computers, and the algorithms figure out what it is that you really want and how the distance between those two things is indicative of a certain type of person who wants certain things, and they go from there and figure out exactly who your perfect match is.
Can you give us a sense of what the questions are?
Well, the questions are all over the place. I mean, some of them are pretty basic. You know, the questions about yourself, obviously, you describe yourself. You describe your what you do, what your values are, what your religious beliefs are, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then correspondingly, what you're looking for. This other site, OkCupid, has their questions are basically provided by the users. And what they have is they have questions that seem totally nuts, but they've found that there are correlations between seemingly mundane questions and deeper, more important revealing tendencies. For example, they found that the question of whether you'll sleep with someone on the first date, right? That's not a question you're going to ask someone if you're about to go on a first date. But apparently, the question of whether you sleep with someone or not on the first date, the answers to that question correlate perfectly or nearly perfectly to the question, do you like the taste of beer? So if you say you like the taste of beer, you are also the kind of person who says, yes, I will sleep with someone on the first date. Another question they
Could
found—
Could you stop and say that makes no sense to me? Because most people like the taste of beer, but a lot of people wouldn't sleep with somebody on the first date.
I was surprised. I thought that maybe people are more honest about the taste of beer in the questionnaire. I mean, I don't know. But another good one is, do you like horror movies? Apparently, if two people both feel the same way about that, they have a better chance of getting along. Like it's a very revealing question about compatibility. And when you think about it, I don't know. I've I've sort of informally done a poll, and it seems to bear out anecdotally. Do you like horror movies?
Well, I'd have to say, which kind? Are you talking about horror movies from the 80s or classic horror films like Frankenstein and Dracula? Are you talking about, Val Lewton movies or splatter films?
You're taking the fun out of it.
No,
yeah.
No, but that's the thing. I can't do questionnaires because
I had the same problem.
I always do this whole, well, what do you mean by that?
They're really binary.
Yeah.
They're really binary. And, the political questions seem sometimes simplistic. The religious questions seems simplistic. I sometimes felt inspired to write little essays in the box they provide, which have no bearing, but it's just – and then you come across like a pedant, I'm agnostic, but let me explain that, I'm not going to get any dates that way.
I remember the first time I knew somebody who had looked for a partner or a date through a personal ad, and this was – this was in the 70s. And it was somebody who did it through, like, the New York Review of Books. And I thought, wow, that is just so weird to do a personal ad. And he really, I think, loved the person who he met. And they were together long distance, on and off for some time. And it's so common now to meet people that way. It just, not necessarily through the New York Review of Books or through like an ad in hard copy, but through some kind of service like that. It just is so interesting how the landscape has changed and how common it's become.
If you were to do, a straight history of internet dating, you'd have to go back and look at the New York Review of Books and their personals as sort of a watershed thing, because they made they took it out of the sort of the back alley and they made it into an art form, the profile or the classified ad. And, that strain sort of continued on in Nerve.com later in the, late 90s, and it's still going. The idea of the clever, well-curated personal profile, which is very much a part of it. I mean, Facebook and that kind of thing also contributes to that. But, those old ads in the New York Review of Books were important.
Well, Nick Palmgarden, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Nick Palmgarten's article about online dating sites is in the current edition of The New Yorker. You'll find a link to his article on our website, freshair.npr.org. New York pianist Thelonious Monk spent a month in California in 1959. In Los Angeles, he played at the Hollywood Bowl, and his wife Nellie was hospitalized with gastrointestinal problems. Monk then traveled alone to San Francisco to play at the Blackhawk nightclub. The first night, his musicians arrived late, and he had to play two sets with last-minute replacements. The next day, he went into a North Beach auditorium to begin work on a solo album appropriately called Thelonious Alone in San Francisco. It's just been reissued. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
Thelonious Monk on the 1940 chestnut Everything Happens to Me, from 1959's Thelonious Alone in San Francisco. The third of his four solo albums, and maybe the most obscure, it's now back out on OJC. Monk did like to dig out old tunes. That same album includes Irving Berlin's Remember from 1925 and a couple of all but forgotten songs, You Took the Words Right Out of My Heart and There's Danger in Your Eyes, Cherie. On one level, Monk was a far-out pianist with his brittle discords, homemade keyboard technique, and unnerving hesitations and silences. But he was always drawing on the past. That's why both jazz avant-gardists and traditionalists revere him. He attacked the keys with a peculiar flat-fingered approach that let every note ring out. It slowed him down a little, but he can surprise listeners who think he always took his time. Monk got part of his training from the old stride pianists who dominated New York in the 20s, like James P. Johnson and Willie the Lion Smith. Monk's sound was always chunkier and more deliberate, but they did teach him tricky left-hand stride patterns. On Blue Monk, he sneaks up on him. There's no gimmickry to it, no showboating. Almost overreaching there at the end. Other solo jazz pianists, like Art Tatum, showed off their virtuosity, but Monk's solos were more about the compositions and making the piano hum. In that way, these pieces recall Jelly Roll Morton's 1920s solos on tunes he'd been writing for decades that sketched the very emergence of jazz, with his expressive piano painting in the details. And Morton was clunking on adjacent keys like Monk by 1923. Monk's biographer, Robin Kelly, connects one new blues here, Blue Hawk, to a record Monk had been given by percussionist Guy Warren from Ghana. Listen to Warren's talking drum part here. And compare that to the riff Monk uses to jumpstart Blue Hawk. On Thelonious Alone in San Francisco, Monk also plays three of his own classic ballads with minimal improvising, illustrating a few ways of framing the melody and his carefully worked out disharmony. Monk could seemingly bend notes on piano by striking two adjacent keys and quickly releasing one. The short note seems to slide into the held one. On Reflections, he's very particular to bend one note in the melody every time it comes around. It's one aspect of his art in microcosm, a tiny reminder that for all his looking back, he found new things the piano could do.
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He's also the author of the new book, Why Jazz? A Concise Guide. He reviewed Thelonious Alone in San Francisco on the OJC label. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.